this week on Art in the Air features author Christopher C. Gorham about his new book, Matisse at War, Art and Resistance in Nazi-Occupied France. Next, fashion and jewelry artist Annika Decker sharing her worldwide journey landing in Northwest Indiana. Our spotlights on the upcoming fall events at Miller Beach Art and Creative District with Julia Gibbs.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, Julia Gibbs, who's the executive director. And they have a whole bunch of things going on. We had them on before to talk about Dance on Lake Street with the things that's ongoing. But they have a whole bunch of things. And you can always check it out at millerbeacharts.org. Julia, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to see you again, Julia.
We're really excited about all the activities that are going on over here on Lake Street this summer. And I should mention, first of all, that yes, Dance On continues, and we're going to have two more dates coming up in August, August 13th and 30th. We will have another salsa lesson with our favorite instructor, Carlos Martinez, and an evening of 80s dance music spun by DJ Quinn. That'll be a lot of fun. So people can put on their 80s outfits and come out and boogie down.
Have they been well attended?
They've been wonderfully attended. We've been having a great time. And I think the whole community has just loved coming out, even though it's been a little hot. You know, we've really enjoyed being outside and dancing. There are ones that we've been doing inside, and those are also equally well attended in the aircon. It's been great.
So what else do you have going on?
So we just opened a beautiful new exhibit called Through the Needle's Eye, which is in our gallery right now. And it is an exhibit of eight nationally recognized textile artists. And it was curated by Miller Beach artist Jane Wedby, put this whole show together. It is extremely beautiful. I encourage everyone to come out and take a look. Now, if people are coming out expecting sort of like, you know, quilts that they might have seen on, you know, grandma's bed or something like that, they're in for a very exciting surprise, because this artwork is astoundingly beautiful. It's exquisite and really complex. It's artists who are using really traditional techniques in very untraditional ways. That show is going to be running through August 29th, and we have a couple of associated activities as well. There'll be a curator's talk on August 24th at 2 p.m., and that's free. Jane will be here to talk about the artists and their work. And she's also leading a workshop called X the X, Beyond the Cross Stitch, which is a workshop basically taking the ideas from this show and teaching people how to use embroidery in non-traditional ways. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And that takes place on August 23rd. And people can sign up for that class at millerbeacharts.org.
What is the cost of it?
That class is $25. And again, the curator's talk is free.
And what else is going on? I know there's a fundraiser in September, the golf fundraiser. Are there still sponsorships available for that?
Sure, absolutely. The golf fundraiser, the golf outing that we do at Innsbruck Country Club every year is one of our largest fundraising efforts, and it's always really well attended. Our golf tickets sell out, but they are available right now. And again, people can go to our website and check out all the details. That is a full day, 18 holes of championship golf, and that includes all kinds of great things. Dinner, a quick lunch, there are snacks along the way, a swag bag. It's a lot of fun. People really, really enjoy that fundraiser lots. And those live music at dinner as well.
Do you have people that are called riders? Like that if they don't golf, they can rent a cart and be part of it that way?
You know, this year we're offering dinner tickets individually from the golf date. So if you have a spouse who's a golfer and you're just not, you can catch up with them at dinner and enjoy a really good meal.
So you also have the 22nd annual Fest in the First. Can you describe that day?
Sure. Yes. Fest in the First is a long running street festival here on Lake Street that celebrates Gary's First District, thus the name Fest in the First. A couple of years ago, we started offering an arts corridor as part of that festival, and we're continuing that tradition now and actually hosting the festival through the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. It is a free festival for families to come out, bring kids, adults, everyone, and enjoy a full day of kid activities, art activities, live music, their food vendors. Our brick and mortar stores come out and have special menus for people to try their food. It's a really fun day, and we're excited this year to have a lot of people coming out to vend. Our vending applications are open right now, and people can find that information at festinthefirst.com. Festival takes place on September 20th from 3 to 8 p.m., I should mention.
Yeah. Is the Miller Community Theater doing anything?
They're going to have a show coming up in the fall, and I believe they'll be holding auditions later in September, early October. They'll be doing a play called Almost Maine. And when I have more information on that, I'd be very happy to share it with you.
That's great. So, and anything else into later fall and early winter?
Actually, we will have another exhibit coming up in September that is really pretty exciting. It's a solo show, so quite different from the one we've got up right now, by an artist named Irena Sivek. She is an artist who splits her time between Chicago and Miller Beach. She's an illustrator and a sculptural artist, originally from Krakow, Poland. So if people can come out and see that on September 5th is the opening date for that show, we would very much love to have you here.
And if you have artists out here who listen to our show, interested in exhibiting, who they contact you, how they do that?
Yeah, they can go to our website to get all of our information. I recommend they go to millerbeacharts.org, and they can find everything about our events, our exhibits, and how to apply to show their work here as well.
And where can they call you, and where you're located?
We are located at 540 South Lake Street, and they can call 219-885-9114.
Excellent. Well, that's a lot of things going on in Miller Beach at the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. Thanks, Executive Director Julia Gibbs, telling us all about that. Again, you can find out more at millerbeacharts.org, Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts, 540 South Lake Street. Julia, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you, Larry, very much. Thank you, Esther.
Yeah, thank you. It's always good catching up with you.
Absolutely. Have a great afternoon. Thanks.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. And Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program.
This is author Christopher Grayson, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Christopher C. Gorham to Art on the Air. Christopher is a lawyer, educator, and acclaimed author. His first book, The Confidant, The Untold Story of the Woman Who Helped Win World War II and Shape Modern America was a Goodreads Choice Award finalist. His newest book is Matisse at War, Art Resistance in Nazi-Occupied France. It explores the wartime experiences of one of the most celebrated artists of the modern era. Christopher is a frequent speaker at conferences, literary events, colleges, and book club gatherings. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Christopher. It is wonderful meeting you. And thank you for this completely engaging book.
That's wonderful. Esther and Larry, thank you for having me. Art on the Air, thank you for having me on today to talk about this dramatic chapter of Henri Matisse's life.
Well, we also want to know more about you. Our audience always likes to know about our guests. Call it their origin story. So tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Well, I think I would go back to being a history major at the University of Michigan and an English minor, and also came from a family that had a pretty big library in our house, and loved to read, loved the stories that were in the, you know, the history books. And in college, you know, the history curriculum there really sharpened my writing and research skills. And I learned to like to write, even going back to college years. And when I went to law school, Larry, you know, it was more research at a higher level, the stakes were higher, and it was more writing. And, you know, I think most people know that about lawyers, but they have to write a lot, and not only research, but the writing aspect as well. And like with a judge, you know, or a client, you're trying to tell a story with your writing that is clear. And sometimes you're limited by time and by page count. So I think that is those skills were skills that I really had to rely upon. And then thirdly, I think origin story. When I began teaching about 15 years ago, I needed to ramp up my storytelling. So it wasn't just the research or the dry writing or the convincing a judge. It was trying to keep 17-year-old high school students awake at 7:35 in the morning. And, you know, I credit them and I credit teaching with sharpening those storytelling skills. So I think you put the three together, you have research, you have the ability to write, and you have hopefully the ability to tell compelling stories for a lot of people. And I think those are the skills that really I've brought to bear on my first two books.
Was the family a storytelling family? So where does this start?
Oh, it starts, Esther, the answer is yes. But for me, the North Star was always history. And I can pinpoint to you the exact moment I was at my maternal grandfather's house. He'd been an officer in World War II, a lovely man. Again, he had a big library too. But one day he took out a cigar box, and young listeners won't know what this is, but it was a cigar box. And he opened it up and it had photographs of World War II. It had medals and patches and news clippings and, you know, photographs of him in uniform and the men that served with him. And I was just astounded and mesmerized. And, you know, even last week at a conference in Washington, D.C. with the National World War II Memorial, you know, that still that moment resonates with me all these years later, just being bitten by the bug of history and falling in love with it. So the storytelling, the history behind it was something that's been with me for a very long time.
Yeah, familial thing. And so what about in school, though? Were you writing in school and getting recognition for that? Did they, you know, help you? Did they guide you along that path as well?
Yes, I had a very, an absolute legendary professor at the University of Michigan named Sidney Fine, who taught there, if you can believe it, from a little bit after World War II all the way until the early 90s.
Wow.
The stretch of history that he called from the sublime to the ridiculous. You know, we're talking about going from, like, you know, FDR and Truman all the way to more current times. But he was, you know, he was a shaper of student writing in a way that made sense to me. You know, he said, it's three parts is what he said, Esther. He said, first, lay out the facts. Don't editorialize. Just tell the people what the facts are. And the second section of your paper, you know, talk about what other historians have said about these facts. And the third part of your paper, that's your time to evaluate and make your case. And, you know, I think writing now is a little more loosey-goosey, but those fundamental rules were good rules to begin with. And he was a wonderful teacher of writing and a wonderful teacher of history for thousands and thousands of people that went to the University of Michigan.
It seems like that structure would fit right into being a lawyer. And which brings me to the second question is, what type of law do you practice?
I began as a litigation associate, worked for a pretty big firm here in Boston. And after, I don't know, about 10 years of that, my wife and I started doing some real estate law and some wills and trust and, you know, some sort of general, you know, small town lawyerly stuff. And that's where we are today. But when I started teaching full-time 15 years ago, I still have my license. I still occasionally help out with some legal matters. But from about 15 years ago, I've devoted my time to teaching.
Excellent. Yeah, that's it. That's fantastic. And what subjects do you teach?
Modern American history, modern America, from about Theodore Roosevelt to about the present day.
Right. It's important that we learn our lessons from history. Otherwise, you make mistakes from the history that you don't remember. And I think sometimes we're suffering with that right now a little bit.
Absolutely. I agree.
So your previous book, that was your first book that you came out with?
Yes. I had done a little short pieces of writing for Heather Cox Richardson, who's someone that I'm sure some of your listeners would know. She had a website called WeirdHistory.org, and I did a few short pieces of her. She is, as your folks know, is an amazing, amazing, beautiful writer. And just having her edit these short pieces for me was very instructive. And it kind of whetted my appetite for a longer form piece of writing.
And it's something I always like to ask writers is, so you put your heart and soul into writing, and then you have an editor. Tell us that process, and, you know, can it be a love-hate thing, or, you know, how does that work? I just heard a thing on NPR about how she's better known as an editor than her own writing. But tell us about that relationship.
Sure. And Liz May of Kensington, if you're listening, it's a love relationship. this is how I describe it to people who ask about what commercial writing is like. You have an editor who shapes your narrative and makes formative comments. So, for example, one of the things that Liz wanted to see more from me was Marguerite Matisse, who is Matisse's daughter.
Right.
And, you know, I thought she was threaded through the story pretty well, but Liz was wise and correct to want me to ramp that up, ramp up her part of the book, her presence in the book. So there's that sort of formative editing that goes on. They shape the narrative and make sure that it's going to hit a lot of readers in a positive way. And then you get to the nitty gritty, you know, which is an amazing skill. You get to sort of the line editing where it's fact checking and making sure that, you know, the French and the Italian words are spelled correctly. And indeed, everything is kind of perfect, perfectly rendered insofar as perfection is able to be achieved. So there's multiple layers. It's an ecosystem. You know, it's sort of this editorial ecosystem between author, sometimes agent, sometimes editor, and sometimes, you know, the more fine-tuning editors. And that ecosystem produced a good product with The Confidant, and we're very pleased with Matisse at War.
So my question would be, why Matisse? You know, he personally, like, Durer and Matisse were my very first art crushes, you know, as a elementary school child. So why Matisse?
It's from a history book, Esther, that I read, or art history, I should say. But I am not, and I should say to everybody, you and Larry and everybody, I am not a art professional in any way. I am more a history professional, I guess would be more accurate. So I was reading this book years ago. It was called Artists Under Vichy. It was about the artist who endured in that part of France that was a sort of subservient puppet state in southern France during the German occupation. And the scholar that wrote that book really took Henri Matisse to task for, in her estimation, almost being in cahoots with the Vichy regime. Mm-hmm. And I kind of filed that away. And a few years later, I was reading another book, and I came across information that Matisse's daughter Marguerite had actually been in a resistance network and had actually been, you know, arrested by the Gestapo. So I thought to myself, something doesn't seem right. You know, Matisse can't both be, you know, not doing enough or almost pro-Vichy and also have a daughter that he loves very much be in the resistance fighting fascism. So that was the gravamen or the spark of the idea to delve into this more and find out what was going on. What was Henri Matisse doing during the occupation of France in World War II?
You know, one thing that your book reminded me of, and I don't know if you're familiar with the motion picture, The Night of the Generals.
Yes,
with Peter O'Toole as General Tance. And they go to, and I think it is in Paris, that where they go to a closed museum of degenerate art.
Yes,
and, of
yes.
course, he stares at the picture. I think it's of Van Gogh, the self-portrait. And, of course, you see that moment where, you know, because he's kind of mentally unbalanced because he's murdering prostitutes as part of the movie. But that part of this whole thing about the degenerate art being closeted away, and yet there's a fascination with it. That sort of prompted that thought to hit me. So
there's a photograph in the book that is Herman, you know, Matisse was lumped in with the degenerate artist, and he was, you know, I guess we use the word canceled now, but his works were stripped off the museum walls and taken out of collections and hidden away in storerooms, except for, you know, five or six Matisses that Hermann Göring wanted to have in his collection.
Right.
So it's actually a photograph of, you know, the second in command of the Third Reich at a Paris museum, you know, ogling these two Matisses. It's just flabbergasting.
Well, I think this brings us to a point that maybe we want to hear a little bit from the book. I think you're going to start with the prologue, but give us a little sample of what you know, the readers out there can discover in it.
Sure. I'll start in Nice, France in 1938 as the book starts. And it's a moment where, you know, Henri Matisse is still a world-famous artist, but he's lost to a lot of people. He's lost his fastball. He's no longer at the tip of the avant-garde, and he's kind of past his prime to a lot of people. The Mediterranean sun was already fiery by the time the flower sellers opened their stalls at the Corsalea marketplace in Old Nice. To the dismay of the small-time merchants and cafe owners, tables remained empty, and the open-air square did not see its usual throng of perspiring tourists and French women toting woven baskets. The cacophony of languages, French, English, Italian, and Russian, used in bargaining for antiques, leather goods, or watercolors, was only a murmur. The crowds had been thinning through the spring out of fear of invasion from Benito Mussolini's fascist Italy, just 30 kilometers away. Thousands of Niçois and visitors alike took refuge inland, away from the southeastern tip of France and the frontier with Italy. The few café habitués in Corsalea that day could hear chirping birds, church bells echoing from the other quarters of the city, and the fluttering of the French tricolor angled from a balcony. At the eastern end of the market was a 17th century Baroque palace bathed in sunlight. Since the 1920s, it too had been of keen interest to tourists. Behind the patinaed facade of mustardy gold lived the internationally famous artist Henri Matisse. Inside the palace, the high-ceiling nine-room flat on the fourth floor with its views of the market and the sea, was Matisse alone. A sight that would have been a rarity in the decades before, when the sole purpose of his wife, Amélie, daughter Marguerite, and his sons Jean and Pierre, the familial raison d'etre, was the creation, evaluation, and successful marketing of the father's art. "We are one of those rare families whose members live in unity," one of his children said. Now his kids were scattered, and his 40-year marriage to Amélie was coming to an end. His sparkling niece, once a refuge, was being hollowed out by the threat of war, and his immense reputation was waning. I'll skip ahead a little bit. That was the summer of 38. I'm going to go back. The previous summer, this will give you an indication of where Matisse's reputation was at this point, France had hosted the Exposition Internationale, attended by 44 nations and dedicated to art, technology, and modern life. The Parisian Planning Committee decided it would be deliciously provocative to situate the massive pavilion built by Nazi Germany directly opposite that of the Soviet Union. In photographs from the official exhibit pamphlet, the two enemy buildings face each other across the Trocadero fountains, like gargantuan chess pieces, as the Eiffel Tower rises in the background like a queen. The architectural confrontation gave the expo's latent sense of looming war the ballast of brick and stone. On other buildings and walls throughout the capital were 718 murals painted by an army of artists commissioned by the French government and the city of Paris to beautify the world's art capital for its worldwide guests. Neither his government nor his city bothered to invite Henri Matisse.
And that Matisse at War, Art and Resistance in Nazi-Occupied France, Christopher C. Gorm's new book coming out in September of 2025.
You know, it's very interesting. Matisse, there were several multiple wars going on, not only the war with Germany and Italy, but also a war within his family. So did you glean, so you were privy to like the personal letters, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so in the book, and I was, as I was reading it, I was like always going, is this from a letter? Is this from, you know, a lot of references were from the book Father and Son, which.
Yes, John Russell.
And I was wondering if those were from personal letters as well, because they were, you know, they were so moving, so much of it.
Absolutely. The letters particularly valuable for me were the letters between Pierre, his son, who lived in New York. His son, you know, starting like 1924, 25, lived in New York permanently, would obviously visit France, but he was a, you know, gallery owner here in New York City. Letters between Pierre and his father were extremely valuable. His son, Jean, was not much of a writer, and so there really aren't letters, or at least not a cache of letters between Jean and his father. But Pierre and his father wrote often until the censors during World War II and during the occupation stopped that flow of correspondence for a time, but they were really invaluable. And another correspondent that was extremely valuable to this story was the elderly artist Pierre Bonnard, who was around the same age and also in not the best of health during these times, and also lived in the south of France. Pierre Bonnard and Henri Matisse carried on a very moving correspondence during these dark years, and I found it, you know, on the one hand, it's sort of like these two old guys kvetching about things, but I also found it very, very moving because they would, you know, in one instance, Pierre Bonnard tells Matisse that, hey, they found these incredible paintings on this cave in Lascaux. You know, these are sort of Stone Age paintings that were in this cave that was found by a French schoolboy during this time. And he sort of marvels at the color of these oxen and deer and animals that were in this cave system. So there's this sense that these two artists, as they talk to each other, are talking, time doesn't really matter. They're talking from prehistory all the way into the future of art that neither one of them will ever be able to see, but they know it will be there.
Well, you can let your guard down with a friend that you cannot necessarily with your family. And so these are his true deep feelings sharing with a friend. It's really,
you're absolutely right. And there's one very, very sweet remark by Matisse. He says to Bonnard, and you know, gasoline was scarce and getting around was very, very difficult at this time. And he says to Bonnard, he says, come visit me in Nice. He says, bring your pooch. And he says, you're going to take the tram, you know, up to my house. And he said, you might have to buy a train ticket for the pooch, but not a place to stay.
You know, and for me, one of the quotes in the books, it was like hearing the same church bells as Ravel gave Matisse a feeling of peace and tenderness. And before that, it was all about how he was harsh because his father was harsh. But as he got older, you know, he was a lot, you know, more of like maybe his true nature was able to be expressed.
I think you're right. He was very economical with his words. And he, you know, he believed that you should paint through your paintings and you should communicate your emotions through your art. That was something that he told his art students when he was a younger art teacher. And really, I think a lesson that he internalized throughout his life. You know, he, you know, would be moving and be candid in his letters, but he was more or less economical with his speaking and let those artworks tell the French people during these dark years that he was on their side, that he was of France, that he was a Frenchman from the very beginning of his life and was not going to leave his countrymen or leave his country during this time of need, and also communicate through his cutouts and through his paintings and his illustrated books messages that the French people he knew would get. And I think that's the subtle and patriotic genius of Matisse during these years.
Yeah, it must have been difficult for him, you know, even in Vichy France, is you have to put on the facade of supporting the Nazi regime in a sense, and yet keeping a low profile, I suppose. But doing just like what you said is making sure his Frenchness was still there without offending the powers that be.
Well, it was amazing to learn in your book that he had two opportunities to leave France, to go to Brazil and to go to California. But here's a quote that he said, "If everyone who has any value leaves France, what remains of France?"
Right. Yes.
It was like really powerful.
And, you know, Pablo Picasso is in Paris and stays, you know, obviously stays on, refuses to leave. You know, Picasso is a rival to Matisse in some ways and a frenemy to Matisse in some ways. But Picasso was Spanish. He was Spanish born. And for Matisse, you know, the born on French soil, lifelong Frenchman was important. In fact, Picasso's companion during the war, Francois Gillot, says he was a beacon of hope. Matisse was a beacon of hope to young French people throughout the war and throughout the occupation.
What's your next project? I know this one's coming out on September 30th of 2025, but what's the next thing on your radar screen?
Well, TBD, another job of editors in commercial publishing is to alight on a topic that sort of fits in with maybe previous books, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
So you don't want to go too far afield from, if you're trying to establish a brand as a writer or author, you don't want to go too far afield. So we're still horse trading and we're still having discussions at the highest levels. I kid. But we're still having discussions about that third book. But it's an exciting newish career for me. And I feel very gratified to not only tell the story of Anna Rosenberg in my first book, but to bring to readers the story of Henri Matisse and his family and their bravery and courage in occupied France during World War II.
In our final moments, tell us how they can find out about your book. It's coming out, I know, September 30th, and also your website and how people can find out about you.
Going to my website, ChristopherCGorham.com, will give you my speaking engagements. We'll tell you where you can buy the book, and also you can look at the video trailer for both of the two books there. So I would encourage people to check that out. And anywhere books are sold, you'll see Matisse at War. Comes out September 30th, 2025, as Larry said.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing the Matisse at War, Art and Resistance in Nazi-occupied France, Christopher C. Gorham, and like you just said, September 30th coming out. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing this very intriguing part of history that's history and art kind of blended together.
Thank you, Larry and Esther and your listeners. It was my pleasure to be with you today.
Yeah, it was completely captivating. Thank you.
Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. We'd like to thank you for listening to Art on the Air. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art on the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art on the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you. Did you know that you can also listen to Art on the Air anytime as a podcast at Lakeshore Public Media's website, through Lakeshore's app, or from NPR? Plus, it's available on demand from your favorite podcast website, including TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon Music, Pandora, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, and many more.
Hi, this is Dorothy Graydon. I'm a contemporary artist in Northwest Indiana, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Annika Decker to Art on the Air. Annika is an artist equally skilled in multiple disciplines. Her artwork and jewelry are inspired by cultures from around the world. She states she is Dutch by origin, African by osmosis, and American by assimilation. Annika had started working with fabrics, leather, and beads in the mid-1960s. She started designing and manufacturing clothing as Anko Fashions brand. While the fashion line has been discontinued, she continues to create her vibrant paintings and jewelry. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Annika. It's marvelous seeing you.
Nice to see you.
Well, Annika, we always like to start our show off with like kind of your background. I call it your origin story, and I think you have a very interesting one. So tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Okay. Well, of course, I was born in the Netherlands, and my husband always wanted to leave. He just wanted to get out and go somewhere. So at one point, we tried to get into America, but we couldn't find a sponsor. So but then the current job that he had offered him opportunity to go to South Africa. And we took that opportunity. So we moved to South Africa after discovering that I was pregnant with my first child. That was a bit of a surprise. So then we lived in South Africa from 1966 to 1979.
Wow.
And then there was my husband became kind of uncomfortable with the situation in South Africa. So then there was an opportunity to come to the United States. I'm sure everybody maybe remembers Solaire.
Yes.
So, and there was a connection with Solaire for him to start his own vacuum pump company. He is, by the way, industrial vacuum expert. So that's why we ended up in the United States, and we've been here since 1979, a long time already.
Did you come directly to Indiana?
Yes. Yeah, we ended up in La Porte, and I mean, now we're in Michigan City, but we've always been in this area.
We want to take you back to where you came from, because we want to clarify that. You came from the Netherlands and growing up there. So maybe tell us a little bit about your early experiences there, because I see on your biography is very interesting.
I was the oldest of a family of seven kids. And my parents were always encouraging us to do things. I mean, make puzzles. Our dad took us on walks through the forest and make little funny landscapes to give to the neighbors with mushrooms and moss and branches and so on. Always drawing, always making things. That's how I grew up.
Did that carry on through school? I mean, in the schooling, was there an emphasis on art and literature?
Yeah, actually, I did. And I've always drawn and painted. And in actual fact, I did what was then called a famous American artist course. And that was then by mail. I had to do my drawings. I had to mail them to the U.S. They looked at them. They came back with comments. They mailed them back.
Oh, wow.
That was then. So that was really funny. So, but yeah, I've always been into art.
So was it in the Netherlands, did you start your fashion explorations or did that happen in South Africa?
That happened in South Africa. My sister, one of my younger sisters also came to South Africa. And we loved shopping in what was then called Vredendorp and the Oriental Bazaar, where they had these small stores, and in the back there were piles and piles and piles of fabrics, old fabrics, beautiful old fabrics, georgettes and painted fabrics from the 1920s and so on. And they let us loose in there, and we could pick up what we wanted. So then we decided to just do that and do some things in South Africa. And we had a Thursday open house every week, and that ended up to be very successful. So that's how I got into the fashion business.
Were you and your sister at first making all the clothing?
Yeah, we made everything ourselves. We designed and made everything ourselves. At the same time, I was also a potter. I was a potter, and I taught pottery to kids. And I had really good teachers, so I really enjoyed that too.
Wow.
So, and then in 1979, we felt we had to leave. So we came here to the U.S.
Did you first come to Northwest Indiana? Was that where, or how was your journey into the United States?
To Northwest Indiana, to where we are right now, La Porte and Michigan City. Yeah, and I mean, I don't regret it at all. We feel very privileged to live here. I mean, it's close to the lake, not that we are beach people at all. But I mean, the climate here is so much better than in other places in this country. So happy about that.
I just wondered how what brought you to that part of Northwest Indiana? I mean, you know, in all the United States, did you have some contact here, some local you knew?
Yeah, the Soler contact. They brought him here. And like a good wife, I followed.
But you followed with Anko, so...
That when I came here, I mean, of course, he went out to work for Soler, sort of his own division there. And I started the fashion business here. And I don't even remember how I got into contact, because I had some really good seamstresses that were all kind of from Korea or Japan. And they were just fantastic. And South America, yeah. So I ended up with a bunch of... First was the two people only. And that's how I got into the fashion business. I did the same here with an open house in the U.S., so in La Porte. So that's... Well, that was actually closer to Michigan City then. So that, and then I did all kinds of fashion shows at Pottawatomie and other places until I did a benefit in Chicago for the American Cancer Society. And one of the then famous boutique picked me up and wanted to carry my line. That's how I got into the national fashion business and into the wholesale business. I sold to all the big department store, to a lot of specialty boutiques for the longest time. And it was a fun time. I really enjoyed that. Until in 1995, I decided that was it. I'd had enough. Was done with it. So then I started painting seriously. So that's why I am here.
Were you painting before? And did any of your paintings show up on the fashion? I mean, were you painting on any of the garments?
Well, did it in such a way that it was kind of like applique, like in an applique form, like flowers on clothes, and that was our signature, with big roses on the shoulders and appliques on the jackets. So that was my kind of fashion drawing then.
So at that point, was it strictly the clothing, or had you added jewelry and other accessories?
We also, at times, my sister also came over to the U.S., and we made jewelry to match the clothing.
Yeah.
We used like pieces of fabric and matching beads, and they were kind of big, bulky necklaces. They were then the fashion in the 80s. So yeah, that was also very successful. So one thing rolled from one thing in another, and so it happens.
It's true. So you continued on with the jewelry. Did you do the jewelry while you were painting, or is that a totally separate?
No, I do them together. I do the one thing or the other thing, whatever I feel like.
I have a question about particular painting. I think it's possibly a series, like the Blue Starburst, Dusk, and Windswept. Are these abstractions of places you personally know, or are they just impressions in general?
It's just impressions in general.
Oh.
Yeah. And I mean, they're all kind of maybe abstract and not so abstract, but still fantasy.
So most of the work is fantasy, except for maybe African musings?
No, everything is fantasy, but it's all based, a lot is based on my African experiences, of course, because I loved living there. So, yeah, and you can see that in my work. There's often an influence like that, even now. Yeah.
Yeah, quite a bit.
And you extended some of your artwork into making art cards. And is that inspired by, like, say, your existing painting, and you take that and make that into cards? Or how, or are they separate pieces of art?
Yeah, no. I just take my existing paintings, and I maybe crop them a little bit. And I can print them here myself. So, I mean, several of the stores have them. So, yeah, and that's another fun thing to do.
Is everything under Anko still?
Yeah, it's Anko. And I mean, I can still run into people that say, ask, when are you going back into the fashion business? Because my signature look was really kind of jersey and very relaxed.
Comfortable, right.
Yeah, very comfortable and relaxed. So no, I'm not, well, I'm doing occasional sewing, but just for myself or for fun.
I see one of the things you're doing, and it looks like on your website the pieces there are sold, is sculpture. So tell us about your journey into doing sculpture.
I've always picked up things, and I guess that started in my childhood. I mean, collecting stones and interesting pieces of wood and branches and so on. And I had a whole boxes here of stuff, and one day I just decided to do something with it, and I really enjoyed it. So I did that. I do that occasionally. They're just small sculptures. Some of them are maybe a foot high, but that's as high as they are. Some are just a few inches. And the first time I did that, I sold a lot. So I haven't done some for a while, but I'm thinking of doing that again.
And do you have a studio in your house? I mean, is that where you work from mostly? Place?
Yes, you can see my studio. We built this new house at Tryon Farm. And we were lucky enough to move in on the day the pandemic was declared.
Oh.
And my sister, one of my other sisters was in Bali, and she managed to come over also on the same day, still flying in. But then, of course, because to help us with the move. And also on that same day, all our stuff had been moved here. So everything was here. So that was so perfect. And they came and helped, and of course they couldn't leave. So then they had to stay and help some more until they finally were able to go back at the end of April. So that was great. We love this place here, and that was the one thing. We designed the house ourselves with the help of an architect. And I always wanted a studio. So this is a little corner of the studio. It's about four times as big. My husband has one little corner, and the rest is mine.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM. Well, you brought up about the pandemic, and we've talked to our artists in the past about that. How did that affect you? I realize you're moving in and setting this up, but after you got kind of settled, was it a period that you withdrew, or was it a very creative period for you? Because, you know, we can't.
No, it was very creative because, I mean, I actually really like being at home. I like being in my studio. I mean, I find it very inspiring. So, yeah, no, I was okay. We were okay. It was nice. It was a nice time. Didn't mind too much. Plus, I mean, we are already old, so we're in our 80s, so that was fine. We've done a lot of traveling in our lives, a lot. So we are perfectly happy now settling down and staying where we are.
So do you still collaborate with your sister?
Oh, yeah. I do. I have a sister in Australia and two in Holland, and we talk every week. So, and I mean, I tell them about my art and they tell me about what they are doing. So, yeah, so still.
So are they also artists?
They don't consider themselves artists. I do. But they dabble. So that's fine.
Yeah, it's still being creative.
Right.
So Annika, is there a kind of art that you have not done that you are interested in exploring? You know, you've gotten this wide variety of jewelry, fashion, sculpture, and of course paintings. But is there something medium or something that you haven't done that you want to do?
I actually also, not so long ago, I started knitting and crocheting. Ah. So that's also what I do. I have scrapbooks that I've done forever. From 1962, when I first started married, I have fashion scrapbooks from 1962 onwards. And now the only thing I'm doing is I'm always on the lookout to see for new things to do, but I don't think there's anything in particular. That I really feel I feel now that I have to do. I mean, I have so much to do that I can do myself with all. I have a huge storeroom. That thing in that doorway in the back is my storeroom, where I have big boxes of beads and actually I want to play with my leftover fabrics, like the leaves and that I left over from the Uncle Fashion's time. So that's still on my program. I haven't quite figured out what I'm going to do, but that's one of the things that I can play with.
Are there any beads left over from the African time, or have you used all
of them? Yes, no, I still have beads left over because I brought a lot. I mean, I brought all my fabrics and all the beads, so I just couldn't leave them behind. And in addition, I brought a whole lots of stones. I mean, big ones, small ones, because I like them.
So are you working on a new series of paintings right now? You know, because each of the series are so wildly different.
Well, I'm always doing something, but I haven't started a new series yet. I'm just playing around. I had a little bit of a, because after the during the pandemic, I got a problem, and I think it is because of the COVID vaccine, that my heartbeat started being very irregular. So it ended up to be so bad that I had to have a pacemaker put in. And after that, I had for a while, I had a hard time getting going again.
Sure.
But now I'm doing okay. Yeah, so no, that's fine.
And you look magnificent.
Well, thank you. So do you. I still like your glasses.
Oh, thank you.
So you have a thing coming up. It's actually through the Lebesnik Center for the Arts, and you have a thing in October 12th, and actually two different sessions, where you're going to have, like, invite people in to see your home and see all the work there and everything like that. So just tell us a little bit about what that experience will be like.
Well, we have on the other side of this studio, we have a big angled hallway, which we call the gallery, because I have all kinds of African, collected when we were in Africa, of course, African pieces, original ones, and just street art, mm-hmm. which are all on little shelves all the way along. So I want to show that to people. And then, of course, they can come into my studio and look at everything that I have around.
So yeah, it's an exciting program, the visits to the homes.
Yeah, and of course, in the middle of August, I also have the art festival, the Lebesnik Art Festival, where I'll be showing mostly my jewelry, some small paintings, and some of the little sculptures. So that's on the 16th and 17th of August at the Lebesnik Center Art Fair.
Can you quickly describe what the sculptures consist of? Are they mixed media or are they pottery?
No, they're not pottery. They're the sculptures that he was talking about. I put them on little pedestals that I made out of foam with weights under it. And they just may have a piece of wood, often with a gold ball by it. Don't ask me why. And I mean, they're just, sometimes they have wings. I did things that are called wing things. So, yeah, no, they're just small.
Well, gold seems to feature in quite a lot of your paintings, too. I mean, the ones that I can pull up in my memory, I remember there's flashes of gold.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Yeah, everything kind of goes together, I suppose. That's what happens when you are one person.
One person.
you have your own experiences, and they get incorporated into everything.
Do you have a project that you're down the road or an exhibit coming up later on past, obviously the art fair and the art festival, but something going on like that that you're coming up on?
Well, next, I am a member of the Area Artists Association, and I'm helping organize an art show at the LaPorte County Visitor Bureau with the rest of the artists. Mm-hmm. So that's in April and May of next year. So that's coming up. And then for the rest, if the area artists have a show, I may participate sometimes or sometimes not.
I know, as a member, I do sometimes too. And sometimes I have to opt out of different ones, you know, just because of scheduling and everything.
And sometimes it's just too far to drag the stuff over. But I like to participate. It's a nice group of artists and they're doing great. So, yeah, good thing. I'm very happy. I'm in my mid 80s, but I'm really happy right now. We love this place where we live right now.
Well, you know, it's beautifully situated with the grounds. You know, you just have, you're right in smack dab in nature.
Yeah, yeah. And we are right on a little pond, so lots of wildlife to look at and
lots of inspiration.
Yeah, that's right. So really nice.
We're in our final minute and a half here, so we want to give you a chance to tell how people can find you online if they want to reach out to maybe have a commission, and we'll repeat about the visitation on October 12th.
Okay, well, of course, we are at Tryon Farm, 29 Tryon Farm Lane, so they can get there, and they can go and look at my website, Annika at OncoArts, with an S, .com. And of course, I'm on Facebook and Instagram, but I don't particularly like that, so I don't care too much about that. So that's about it.
Well, you know, we really appreciate you sharing your great art journey from the Netherlands to South Africa to landing in Michigan City, LaPorte area, and sharing your art. And, of course, we remind people that if they want to go to the tour that's coming up at your home, they can reach out to Nicole at thebezickcenter.org. They want to find out information about you. It's OncoArts.com. That's AnkoArts.com. And you find out everything you want to know about our guest today, and we're afraid to ask. Annika, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Years and sharing your great art journey.
Okay, that was a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.